You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, I'm Robert Wright. I run the Non-Zero Foundation, which produces all the shows on Blogging Heads TV and Meaning of Life TV. We host a variety of voices, some of them pretty unorthodox, and we encourage dialogue that is sharp but civil. We think fostering constructive conversation is especially important now that America and the world are looking kind of fragile. If you agree that our mission is important, I hope you'll consider helping us shoulder the cost. You can do that by becoming one of our cherished patrons at patreon.com/nonzerofoundation. That's NONZEROFOUNDATION. Thanks. We need your help, and we deeply appreciate it.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
So you're team David Lee Roth or team Sammy Hagar?
I was futzing with my computer, and I'm hearing Matt Gidell Van Halen nostalgic listening to Sammy Hagar's Van Halen, which is not is Van like Halen.
This is like a Trump rally. I need, I need entrance music to get me psyched up for this.
Why would you choose How Do I Know When It's Love for that?
Well, because I'd already heard Jump this morning. My kids are getting the video to Jump. I'm sure you've seen it a million times.
Sure.
It was on MTV. David Lee doing some pretty impressive karate kicks and stuff and splits.
He is a bona fide rock star.
Yeah.
And, Sammy Hagar sold Crystal Pepsi. So I don't know how we could even, put these two in the same league.
That was a weird Pepsi commercial thing they did. it was clear. Would you say Crystal?
That's what it was called, Crystal Pepsi.
I bet you young people don't even know that this existed.
Probably not.
Right? It's been, airbrushed from our history. Let me ask you this. Here's something we don't talk enough about. Hands Across America. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
I was part of Hands Across America.
Did you successfully have a chain with no breakage points?
As far as I know, I'm told that in the Midwest they had to have cows involved, with their holding tails to go through Nebraska. But there's this podcast Stuff You Should Know, and I think I'm about to email them. My son wants me to try to get them to do one about are you familiar with the great molasses explosion in Boston?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it, yes.
Yeah, so my son is obsessed with this, so he wants me to encourage them to do an episode. But I'm going to say Hands Across America, too. And why not Crystal Pepsi while we're at it? I mean, forgotten.
So, Matt, I don't know why you're stalling here, because
it's just light banter.
You have to be just over the moon with the Amy Coney Barrett hearing. This is what you've been dreaming of ever since Trump got inaugurated. I will suffer all that I can bear if I can get Amy Coney Barrett,
no.
And now you're getting her.
No, you're making it sound like I said I would. I think you're suggesting to people who are not familiar that I was – that I made a deal or a bargain.
Well, you did it. You're getting off scot-free. You didn't actually vote for Trump.
Yes.
You're having your cake and eating it too. But this is what you wanted out of a Trump presidency.
Well, I mean, if you're going to have to take the downside of a Trump presidency, you should get something in return. And so I consider, I count my blessings. There hasn't been much to be happy about. This would be one of them. I'm still just, it's not a fait accompli yet. I mean, we thought that the Brett Kavanaugh hearings were basically winding down. So who knows if there's going to be some crazy attempt to say that she engaged in gang rape or something. You know, maybe there'll be an accusation against her that's going to come out to slow this down. So I don't dance in the end zone, Bill. I'm not celebrating yet.
But you are certainly, you must be happy with how things have gone so far.
Yeah, it looks, I mean, I think everyone says it looks good. I think she came across really well. I mean, dude, could you imagine enduring like 2 or 3 days of like 10 to 12 hours of these senators, you know, lecturing you, interrogating you. It's a rough gig, you know, but then you get the lifetime
This is the cushiest gig on the planet. So if you have to go through a couple of days of questions, I think you can handle that trade off. And she, you know, it's like, ooh, she's working without notes. She is a law professor. I mean, she does live and breathe this stuff. So it's not like she really needs the notes to know about her own writings and her own opinions.
Yeah, it would be like, although I would say, if you were to be like, Matt, in 2012, you wrote this piece about Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. I don't know that I would hold up, under that scrutiny, but you, wait a second. In 2011, you wrote this.
Is there anything, I mean, as folks on the left are watching this, their degree of horror is escalating over the course of the hearings. This is the first time when a nominee has been openly pro-life, and there's no attempt to cloak that or mitigate that in the course of the hearings. They're openly talking about what is required to overturn precedents. She is separating almost every decision outside of Brown v. Board and Loving v. Virginia as not super precedent, but just precedent. I mean, that's not even just in terms of Roe, but in terms of Griswold v. Connecticut, which is the marital birth control case that laid the groundwork for or established a right to privacy. She would not say that Social Security or Medicare was constitutional. She wouldn't, I mean, the Social Security rulings were in 1937, but she didn't call that super precedent. Does any of
her,
that
her definition, and she's getting this, I think, from some academics, but her definition of super precedent is something that is so settled to the point where it is not challenged, that nobody
nobody's challenging Social Security's constitutionality in any kind of serious way. She could have said, oh, that's super precedent too.
Maybe she could have, but correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that she is citing someone else's work, like the academics who put this together had a list of like 6 or 7.
But she's
examples.
Embraced it. I mean, she has written in her law review articles, you know, using that definition and taking it as plain fact. You know, she's not saying someone else said this and I'm not so sure about it. She's saying I have leaned on this to define these things in my own writings, and this is how I am characterizing them. And she is explicitly not giving that characterization to Social Security, to the rulings related to Social Security, to Griswold. It's not like there's some organized attempt to overturn Griswold, as far as we know.
Well, you're not going to the same meetings I'm going
to. This is what I'm asking you, Matt. I mean, so when you're hearing this, are you saying, wow, she's even more radical than I thought? Or you're going, yeah, baby. Yeah, none of this is constitutional. Let's tear it all down.
My take is I just see her as a mainstream. I think she is obviously a Catholic conservative, but I see her as being very mainstream, very qualified. I also think that, you know, that she is someone who is going to judge cases through basically her judicial philosophy as an originalist and a textualist. So I think that she may, like, I think if conservatives are expecting her to show up and basically be Sarah Palin or something, they're going to be disappointed. And I think progressives, I think that a lot of the outrage, I don't know where the outrage, I don't think the outrage is necessarily deserved. I mean, it is going to change the court. There's no doubt about that. But I don't think it's like going to be a radical thing. And, you know, you and I disagree a little bit.
I mean, it would be a radical thing if you overturn these things. I mean, that would be radical decision making.
Well, right. But you and I disagreed, a little bit on Twitter over like the point of, you know, how Lindsey Graham, I think, especially was talking about precedent and really established the fact that, like, Amy Coney Barrett can't show up and decide, I want to overturn such and such law. You know, they went through kind of the rigors that there would have to be someone who has standing to bring a case, and then lower courts would have, there would have to be the appeals process, and then the Supreme Court would have to actually decide to take up the case. And of course,
these are all surmountable hurdles. I mean, Graham and Barrett, at the literally the first thing of the entire hearing was to walk through in very calming tones. Oh, if one was to overturn a precedent, how would one do it?
See, this is such a Rorschach test, because I think when you heard that, that's what you heard, that this was like creating a permission structure or trying to normalize this in people's minds. Why would Graham do this? Clearly, it was to show the immense obstacles that are in the way of overturning any precedent.
I do not think that is what is so clear.
Then you're saying that Graham is either, you know, sort of making an argument against interest, or he's laying the groundwork for a long-term plan to overturn Roe?
Well, look, I don't think it should be assumed that the first order of business of a 6-3 court is to overturn Roe the first chance that they get. It is certainly possible. I mean, based on her own lower court opinions, so I'm not just being theoretical based on her law review writings, based on her judicial opinions, she would weaken Roe. She would say various state laws that would restrict access to clinics, for example,
sure,
would be admissible and constitutional under Roe Casey. So she would literally overturn Roe Casey, but she would really narrow its scope.
Yeah.
I think that is very, very probable.
I think that's perfectly plausible.
But in that dialogue that they had, I believe this was an attempt to normalize, to give the permission structure, to say it would not be radically out of bounds for the Supreme Court to look at a long existing precedent. Roe v. Wade is coming up on 50 years. But just because it's 50 years, if it is being challenged, the mere fact of challenge makes it not super precedent. And therefore, you then go through these other steps to decide whether it should be overturned. To do that, you know, out in the open, to do that very first thing in the entire hearing process this is something that, you know, John Roberts didn't go anywhere near. Now, John Roberts was a little cagey on Griswold in his hearing. He did something similar in Griswold, came out and was like, oh, sure, marital birth control. Who would overturn that? As if that is the entirety of Griswold v. Connecticut. You know, then that's sort of what Barrett did. So it's not like Roberts didn't have his signals, but they didn't have anywhere near the kind of in-deep discussion about how one would overturn. I mean, Roberts, when I was waiting to say stare decisis, man, do I love stare decisis. That's some good stuff.
Yeah. And I think Roberts is a good example of why the freak out is overwrought, because last time I checked, Roberts isn't a great, pushing a right-wing agenda on the court. but anyway, let me just say, I think we see this very differently. I mean, Barrett was responding, ACB was responding, was responding to, Graham's line of questioning and all that. But I think the entire premise here was to calm people. It was not to scare people. It was to basically say, you're not going to show up and try to do and like with an agenda. Because you can't, because that's not the role of a justice. You are basically responding, and there's all sorts of checks and hoops that you would have to jump through. And so I think that the whole line of questioning from Lindsey Graham was to basically just demonstrate that even if she were this, you know, right-wing activist who was out to legislate, you know, from the bench, conservative stuff, like, she couldn't do it. At least it would have to be a very long game. Well, and even then, she's one vote out of nine.
I don't think they are trying.
And by the way, and then, of course, the obvious point would be, if Roe were overturned, it doesn't make abortion illegal. It would just return it back to the state.
Well, here is Matt Lewis, like many conservatives. I had conservatives in my feed all week saying, hey, what's the big deal? Hey, it just goes to the states and you debate it there. So what? I mean, obviously that would be a very big deal. It would be large.
I mean, and I think you could make an argument. I mean, there is one of the arguments here would be like, I'm not a lawyer. I forget the nomenclature, but that would be a factor you would weigh is even if something were wrongly decided, would overturning it have like an undue burden or a disruptive quality? And you can make a Burkean argument that it would.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is possible, that Amy Coney Barrett won't go as far as to outright overturn it. You know, there is enough in her legal writings and her commentary to suggest the possibility exists she will take into consideration how much I believe the term is reliance interest. How much reliance interest is existing and is being right
on
so long.
It was right on the tip of my tongue.
Right. So again, I don't want to take the critique, you know, too far without knowing exactly what would happen. And I don't think that Graham and Barrett had the exchange to upset people. I don't think they're trying to stoke a progressive backlash, but I do think they are normalizing the discussion, and I think this has been a push on the right for a long time. They don't like it that conservative prospects for the court have to hide the ball in their commentary and their work for decades to be considered for the court. They want it to be okay to be forthrightly pro-life and to write openly about overturning precedents and not be disqualified for the court. And they have succeeded. I mean, they're on the verge of succeeding that happening. Why did Harriet Myers get shoved aside for Samuel Alito? They were sick and tired of Roberts was a case where he had a very thin paper trail and conservatives said, trust us, fellow conservatives. We know this guy's Federal Society. He worked for Reagan. I know he hasn't spelled it all out, but trust me, he's going to be good. At that, by 2005, yeah. 6, whatever Alito was, conservatives were like, okay, it's time to raise it up to the next level. Let's get someone who is explicitly conservative. Myers isn't good enough. And they got that. And now Barrett is a next level of paper trail, of documented, anti-abortion conservative. And they're going to get that most likely now.
The only problem I have with that is, you may have a point in terms of why she was nominated, but you're talking about Lindsey Graham's questions and his line of argument and questioning. If it was Josh Hawley asking the question, I would say, yeah, you're totally right. But why would I just don't know that Lindsey Graham is that much of a, I mean, I'm sure he is pro-life, but I just don't know that he has this agenda.
This is the chair of the Judiciary Committee who is essentially representing the entire party. And obviously Graham has his short term political interest to worry about. He is trying to get.
They're killing me. They're coming for me.
Right. I'm not saying that's not a factor either, but I don't think the very first line of questioning is just an individual decision on Lindsey Graham's part. I assume there has been enough discussion between Graham, other party leaders, and Barrett and her team to say, hey, this is what we're going to do to start off. I don't think that's an ad lib improvisation.
So we probably should move on just because I think we just see this very differently. I think that what Lindsey Graham was trying to do was to inoculate her from the charge that she's going to do something radical by establishing the level of difficulty that it would take to overturn anything, and to really just demonstrate the many hoops that, that one would have to go through to overturn anything.
She could have leaned much, much harder on Stare Decisis if that's what they wanted to do. She has, not just in that one exchange, repeatedly separated precedent from super precedent to say this stuff that's not super precedent is yeah. vulnerable to being overturned, and pulled out, you know, Bowers v. Hardwick to Lawrence v. Texas. You know, say, hey, you Chris Coons, you were happy with that overturning.
Yeah. I mean, maybe part of my ears don't perk up just because, you know, again, I think I just agree with her, you know, philosophically. No, I mean, from a judicial standpoint, there could be very evil laws that have been reinforced and upheld and passed that are unconstitutional, and a court should be able to overturn those. But of course, as she noted, there's all sorts of, not only are there obstacles logistically to doing that, but then you would weigh into, you would consider, it's not, you know, having precedent shouldn't be a complete deal breaker, meaning it's impossible to overturn, but you should weigh in the cost, because there is something to be said for upholding precedent. And I thought that she expressed it very well.
But in cases, I think she brought up, I think she brought up Plessy v. Ferguson at some point. And I know that pro-lifers routinely look at Roe v. Wade as akin to Plessy v. Ferguson. But I think it's very different to say overturn this precedent which denied rights to people. Plessy v. Ferguson denied rights to African Americans. Bowers v. Hardwick denied rights to gay Americans. That needs to be expunged. Now, you have very recently,
Roe v. Wade denies rights to unborn people.
Well, that is how pro-lifers look at it. And of course, people who are supportive of Roe say there are adult mothers who will have their rights taken away if you overturn it. That's why there's big disagreement about the subject. But you have Alito and Thomas just this month or last month saying that the decision to that create a constitutional right to same-sex marriage was an error that only the court can expunge. I mean, that's talking about it in the same kind of language as a Plessy. And she wouldn't answer the questions directly about that, which means that she's not looking at it as a super precedent. And that's a decision that extended rights. And so to overturn it would be to take away those rights. And I think those types of actions, I mean, Roe is a case where you have, you know, to be charitable and look at things from both perspectives, conflicting rights. Rights of women, of pregnant women, and rights of the unborn. And you are never, ever, 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 ever going to satisfy both camps on that subject. It is impossible to do.
No, I don't think it's impossible.
I mean,
I think it's impossible to fully satisfy, but if you, you know, maybe if we had allowed it to actually work its way through the legislative process, or maybe we would have like a 20-week ban, or different local communities or states could have decided things that fit their values and their community.
A set of patchwork laws where you have certain rights in some states and you don't have those rights in other states, where if you're a mother with a severe medical condition and a late-term abortion is necessary to save your life, you can get it here and you can't get it there. I think any situation where...
Most of the laws have exceptions for things like that. I do think that it's you can never fully satisfy both sides, because there's a different worldview and it comes down to questions of like when when life begins and things like that. But I do think it would be possible to have compromises that are kind of common sense compromises that would certainly lower the temperature a little bit. So I'm, you know, and I wonder if we might have arrived at those had the court not intervened the way it did.
This is my fear. I think there's this delusion on the right that, I mean, it's one thing to argue that Roe v. Wade contributed to deep cultural and political polarization because it established by fiat something that was working its way through democratic processes at the time. I mean, I'm not sure I totally agree with that, but I get the argument. I think you can take that critique too far and conclude, well, all I have to do is overturn Roe v. Wade and return it to democratic processes at the state level, and our polarization would be solved.
Right.
That's not what's going to happen if that's what occurs, because you are taking rights away from people that have been established for a long time. And the political debate you will have on a state by state and city by city basis is going to be ferocious. And it will not end because
I suffer no delusions. I don't, but
if Barrett does suffer that delusion and others suffer that delusion, they may tell themselves, okay, I can overturn precedent in this case because the reliance interests here are not going to be terribly jeopardized, because the abortion will likely be available in places where it's popular, and that will be enough. Whereas just because, you know, you might be 60-40 on Roe in Alabama, you still got a 40% of people are going to be pretty darn pissed off.
Yeah.
And people outside of Alabama are going to be doing things to help those folks get abortions, cross state lines for that, ship in abortion pills across state lines. I mean, all sorts of things are going to occur that are going to be fractious.
You know, and the way we got down this rabbit hole, is it suffered delusions or illusions?
Delusions.
Delusions. I'm certainly not delusional, so use your illusion. I guess the way I got us down this rabbit hole is by just saying, like, you know, I think the whole point of what Graham and ACB were doing, or what Graham was doing, is establishing that, like, you know, first someone has to have standing to bring a case, and then it has to you know, wind its way through the appeals process. And then the Supreme Court has to decide whether to take it on. And then they would also weigh stare decisis or weigh precedent into the question of whether or not to overturn something. And then if they did overturn it, it still wouldn't outlaw abortion. Now, as I was just like adding that on as like one more point, which is to say, I think the this is why, like, I don't think anyone should, like, I think it, the concern is overwrought. And, of course, though, the Democrats haven't really focused that much on the main thing they're focusing on is the Affordable Care Act
right
now. I think that's an interesting choice that they made. But I also think there, if I had to bet, my bet would be that we don't overturn, you know, the ACA.
I mean, I think it's probably right. I mean, I can't be completely sanguine about it. They had a fairly open discussion about severability, which is, I mean, there's sure two big issues in the case. One is standing. Do the Republican attorneys general who are suing in the first place, they have the standing to have a case? The court can say, you know, you're not being hurt here in any significant way, so you don't have the stand to bring the case. That's a way to kind of cut down on frivolous lawsuits. So they could rule that and say, look, I'm not even going to hear the other parts of the case. You don't have standing. And then the more likely issue this turns on is severability. Even if the Republican Congress taking the individual mandate down to $0, if that renders the individual mandate unconstitutional because it's no longer a tax under the Roberts rubric of the initial Supreme Court ruling, can you say, okay, well, that provision is unconstitutional, but the rest of the law can stay? And I think a very common sense interpretation is we have had this law for several years with no individual mandate, and it still functions. Obviously, it could work.
This is the interesting thing, Bill, because we were told that there would be adverse selection and that you had to have an individual mandate because otherwise, if you don't have an individual mandate, healthy people will not sign up. They will be free riders and exploit the system, and sick people will sign up. And therefore, like by definition, it would be untenable to keep this going. That's what we were told. It makes perfect sense. It hasn't really played out that way.
Well, I think the law doesn't work as well as it could. And that's been the case even before the zeroing out of the mandate. The initial mandate, the penalties were kind of weak. I think they'd have to be stiffer. I mean, you do have free riders. There are still people who are uninsured. Some of that is mitigated because you can be on your parents' plan till you're 26. So it's not like there's no progress in that area. But I think if you had a strong mandate, you would potentially eliminate or vastly mitigate the free rider problem. But the law, it's not complete chaos without the individual mandate. So I think, I mean, there's that common sense interpretation. There's the fact that the Congress that zeroed the mandate was unable to repeal it. So to argue they had the intent to repeal it, I think doesn't wash. You have several senators who are on the record saying, my vote for this, Republican senators, Susan Collins, Lamar Alexander, and others who have said to the court, we did not intend to repeal the law by doing this. So there's all sorts of argumentation to say, if you're being fair-minded about it, that you shouldn't overturn the entire law because of this. The question is, are they going to be fair-minded, or are they going to be partisan activist judges? So we don't know.
My guess is that they're not going to overturn it, which means 80% of what Democrats have been scaremongering this week is going to very quickly. I mean, maybe it helps. Presumably it helps Democrats make the case against Donald Trump on November 3rd. That's the only rationale I can give, because very quickly, their warnings about Barrett are going to probably be proven to be unfounded.
I mean, I think it is possible, maybe even probable, that assuming Barrett is on the court in a matter of weeks, the potential first test is any election-related lawsuits. So you'll know right away, is she going to act as a Trump enforcer? If it's a close enough race to have those sorts of lawsuits.
Yeah.
So there's that.
And let me just say, and I you know, I'm biased. I'm conservative. I wanted Barrett to be picked instead of, who's the last guy?
Kavanaugh.
Brett Kavanaugh. Thank you. I wanted Barrett a couple years ago.
Yeah.
So I'm biased, admittedly biased. Having said that, I truly believe that she, like, the idea that she is beholden to Trump or will be beholden to Trump, I find completely absurd. I think it is more like, to the extent that she will let her judgment be clouded, I think it is much more likely she would rule against Trump to demonstrate, just the way that John Roberts has basically operated, to demonstrate her independence and to preserve the legitimacy of the institution. I hope she'll follow the law wherever it takes her. But I think it is more likely if she doesn't follow, if she allows her personal status to intrude, I think it's more likely she would go the other direction and rule against Trump.
I mean, I think that's probably right. Assuming Trump's case is weak, which
well, I mean,
it probably
if
would
he's
be.
Got a good case. I hope he wins.
Sure,
if he has
sure.
a good case, right?
But if he's just losing and he's grasping at straws, I don't think Barrett saves his bacon, because I mean, they have to know to do something that overtly political would reap the whirlwind.
Right. And just think of her own personal self-interest. Like, you know, does she want to be remembered as the person who did that or not? You know,
the next big test is the ACA ruling, any abortion related ruling that could happen by June. And if in that first set of cases in June 2021, she doesn't do anything radical, then Democrats, those who are articulating the worst, might be a little, a little hemmed in. You know, it wouldn't feed the appetite to pack the court.
Yeah. Now look, let me just say this. If Donald Trump had nominated Matt Gaetz or his sister, meaning Trump's sister.
Trump's sister would be a moderate. I would welcome Trump's sister at this point.
Okay, if he had nominated like Matt Gaetz or a QAnon, I mean, I would be opposing this vehemently. But Amy Coney Barrett is a mainstream, you know, she was Scalia's law clerk. I mean, she's a Notre Dame law professor. She's a legitimate, serious, thoughtful, you know, judge.
So, to your point, though, Matt, you're suggesting Democrats are kind of getting over their skis a bit here. But from, I think, Biden's perspective, one, he wants to make the short-term case that, you know, you have a president who is literally trying to overturn ACA. He has filed the lawsuit. He is supporting the lawsuit to overturn ACA. There is reason to worry. He wants to put somebody on the court to follow through on his desires. That's not, I grant you that Barrett hasn't said anything to explicitly suggest she would act in a political way, but it's not crazy to say Trump would have a mind towards doing something like that. So I think,
well, and what if Trump had done that? I mean, like, Trump could have. I mean,
let me finish this one point.
That's a scary thought to me, that Trump could have nominated a toady. And would Republicans have stood up against it?
Well, the answer to that is no, of course.
I mean, they don't have a great track record. Right. That's why I'm so grateful to have Amy Coney Barrett, Bill.
So Biden has a short-term interest to push that point. Biden probably does not have a long-term interest in court packing based on his own rhetoric. So if it so happens that Barrett isn't as radical in the first year and the appetite for court packing is diminished, that doesn't upset Biden. Now, what I think the bigger concern, you know, ACA and Roe are very big concerns, of course. There's even a broader concern that the Supreme Court will function as a barrier to basic governance. And anything that Democrats want to pass to tackle a big problem, climate change, immigration, any other healthcare laws, voting rights, gun control, anything they want to do, a conservative 60 crew is going to say, nope, can't do it, can't do it, can't do it, can't do it. And you won't know if that is the direction they're going in for a few years. I mean, Democrats have to pass the law, has legal challenges to the law, it's got to go to the district court and the appellate court, the Supreme Court has to take the case. We don't know if that will be made clear within 4 years' time.
Let me say, though, because it's something that they spent a lot of time talking about this week, but I haven't spent a lot of time talking about here. And I have been guilty of referring to her as like a conservative justice. And I noted in the past that you were not pedantic, you know, Bill, and that you realize that's a shorthand. But I truly believe that, I mean, just like, I mean, was it Scalia, for example, ruled, you know, against criminalizing flag burning, I think, right? Yeah. And there were cases like that. I think that Amy Coney Barrett is going to rule based on her philosophy. And so I don't think she's going to have an agenda to destroy the environment or put guns in the hands of everybody. I think she is going to try to look at the law and through the prism of her, you know, originalist philosophy, rule that way. And it very well may be that oftentimes that pleases conservatives. I don't think it's going to always please them. I think there are going to be times, as we've seen with, you know, Roberts and Gorsuch and others, where they may surprise us.
Now, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not a Supreme Court lawyer. I don't profess to have thought through all the ins and outs here. I do know this much. I think you already have five justices who believe in a limited interpretation of the Commerce Clause. So the Commerce Clause in the Constitution says Congress can regulate interstate commerce. Liberal interpretations treat that indirectly. If this hasn't some kind of indirect impact in interstate commerce, then Congress can legislate in that area. And conservatives tend to say it has to literally be about actual, you know, trade occurring across state lines. Otherwise, the Commerce Clause does not apply. The whole issue in the ACA case, the initial ACA case, was that the four liberal justices said Commerce Clause is sufficient to uphold ACA. Robert said, no, I don't think so. I don't see it as legitimate under the Commerce Clause. I do see it as a legitimate exercise of Congress's taxing power, which we talked about, you know, last time.
I believe was right. A reverse engineered invention by Roberts.
As does Amy Coney Barrett. Yeah. But that hinges on in part that the part of the law that's relevant refers to a penalty, but a penalty that is administered through the filing of one's tax return. So if Congress had said this is a tax penalty, then you probably wouldn't have an issue here.
But the people who wrote it thought it was a penalty, not a tax. Barack Obama explicitly said it's a penalty. It is not a tax. Wait,
Democrats had a political reason to not characterize it as a tax because that's a bad political look. The Republicans say this is a tax. But again, to the textualist does not look at legislative intent. They should not look at political rhetoric. They look at the text of the law. And so you could argue that Roberts is looking at the text of the law and say, hey, a penalty that is being administered through the tax return process, I can legitimately interpret that as an exercise of taxing power. I understand a different argument there.
Yeah, and I would just say the only thing that – not the only thing, but sort of the icing on – you know, the cherry on top that makes it pretty clear that Roberts was – you know, because Roberts reportedly at the last minute like switched his vote.
Right.
You know what I mean? So the reporting seems to confirm the suspicion that he was like looking for a reason to uphold this law found.
Whatever the truth there, let's put that aside. The point I'm trying to make is a Democratic president in Congress has to know you are not going to have your laws upheld on the basis of the Commerce Clause. You can forget about trying to justify it with that. You could use taxing power. I mean, there's no dispute that Congress has taxing power. You might have to be more explicit about it. I mean, a carbon tax should be constitutional. I don't know what the argument would be that Congress doesn't have the power to levy a carbon tax. Maybe conservatives will invent one, but that should be a pretty straight shot if that's the path. The Democrats now have to think very carefully, okay, what's going to fly for this court? And so it might be different based on the particular case at hand. I know that taxing power is one that I think is pretty safe ground. It just is a bit of a political challenge because you have to openly talk about taxing, which Democrats generally try to shy away from.
No, I think that makes sense. And I don't think that means that liberals and progressives can never get anything passed anymore. I think it means that they – you know, we'll see if it plays out the way you suspect, but you're probably right, and they'll just have to approach it. And honestly, if it is a tax, then I think we have the right to know that. Like, they should, if it's going to be a tax, sell it as a tax, and the public, you know, can either support that or not, but then at least you're a little more honest about what you're doing.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit. We talked about Barrett a lot.
I'm just getting started.
I know. I mean, we could talk about Supreme Court all day, I'm sure. What do you think about what's happening with the stimulus negotiations? Pelosi is getting a certain degree of pressure to accept the offer on the table from Trump. Pelosi had a very contentious interview with Wolf Blitzer about it. You know, Andrew Yang is pushing her on it. Congressman Ro Khanna is pushing her. Khanna sort of walked himself back a little bit, saying, I'm not saying she has to take this deal, but she should work to have a deal. You know, it's more than just the top line. It's more than just $2.2 trillion versus $1.8 trillion. It's how much is going to states and localities. How's that money being allocated? Should there be workplace regulations to ensure that workers are being protected from the pandemic? Should corporations and municipalities have legal immunity for any pandemic-related instances? You know, should there be money for child tax credit, should be increased unemployment. There's all sorts of sub-issues
here. All those things may or may not be good, but if this is really an emergency and you really want to get money in people's hands, is that the hill to die on? Unless you also think it benefits you politically. And see, I think that's what this is about, right? I mean, Trump made a really stupid move by publicly walking away from the negotiations. And that set him up to, I think, understandably and rightly be blamed for them falling apart. I think Pelosi has calculated that it's in her Democrats' best interest, Joe Biden's best interest, for a deal not to be made between now and the election, because Trump will be blamed. And why would you, if you're Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden, why would you want Donald Trump sending out checks to the public a week before the election? Why would you want the public to get a check from Donald Trump's, you know, federal government? And so I think Pelosi's huge mistake was that interview with Wolf Blitzer. I think she totally lost her cool. And this was not just a slip of the tongue or one contentious moment. This was something that went on for many minutes. And in fact, and I'm a CNN, political commentator, you know, so I'm biased again. You know, Wolf would try to like sort of get out of the interview and be like, okay, Bill, we're going to have to agree to disagree. But the people are paying attention. And she'd be like, they're paying attention because you're trying. I mean, like she was fired up. And I think it was just a huge mistake. Now I think it's much easier to cast Democrats as being to blame for this.
I disagree on the political import of the interview. What's interesting to me, and by the way, I did a shareable about this last night. So
people should listen. This is your YouTube channel.
This is my YouTube. My YouTube commentary. I did a commentary on this, so forgive me if I repeat myself a bit.
And I should say, Bill, you and I have both been complimentary of Nancy Pelosi and her ability to lead her caucus in the past. But I think this was a big mistake, in my opinion.
Well, this is why, you know, I generally give Pelosi benefit of the doubt in her negotiating tactics. I do think she has earned some latitude here based on how she's handled things in the past. But she's getting criticism from certain folks on the left. I'm thinking particularly certain commentators, Eric Levitz at New York Magazine, Zach Carter, Huffington Post, David Dayan at Prospect. And these are folks who are generally not all that thrilled about bipartisanship. I haven't gone through all of their past commentaries. I don't want to charge any individual with hypocrisies here. But as a general matter, folks on the hard left have felt Pelosi has been too nice to Republicans, too soft in her demands, hasn't been political enough, with her negotiating positions, and have been very critical of Joe Biden for talking about bipartisanship at all. In fact, you know, Levitz in particular had a piece during the convention saying that Biden's talk about bipartisanship is disastrous. So why are these folks suddenly chastising Pelosi for digging in her heels here? I think there is an element of dislike for the Democratic establishment and trying to introduce this notion that Pelosi is so soulless and so politically calculating that she is willing to harm the poor, harm the middle class for political ends. And of course, Republicans would be very willing to make this argument too. And I don't think it's fair to assume that. Mind you, you know, she had passed laws. She had made offers to get something done in advance here. I mean, she could have done Mitch McConnell. She could have pulled a Garland and said, "Nope, can't get anything from us. Screw that. You know, I dare you to make an issue of it." But she's been in negotiations. So I think she is willing to make a deal on her terms. Where I think this gets complicated is, it's very possible this is the last bite at the apple.
Yeah.
I think it's a fair argument to say, take what you can get. People are hurting. If you can put money in their hands now, get it to them. You know, I get it. I mean, I think that was
because Republicans aren't going to want to give Biden credit, right? They're not going to want to do this.
Well, this is where I think the politics is very complex. I don't think it's easy to say who has the upper hand after the election. You know, would Trump sign a bill on the lame duck? You know, it seems unlikely. He'd be more spiteful. But maybe Republicans would rather pass something now while they have the Senate majority and wouldn't want to do it, you know, assuming a Democratic majority. Or maybe Republicans have the majority under Biden and can block it then. Maybe Biden would be able to get 6 to 9 Republicans to come over for a bigger stimulus package because they'll be worried about being too obstructionist out of the box, or maybe they want to be super obstructionist out of the box, won't want to give Biden anything.
Like, not just obstructionist, Bill, but the Republicans are going to return to their fiscally conservative roots, right? I mean, there's
maybe,
isn't that the most likely play, that they think, okay, Tea Party time, we're the Tea Party again, spending's out of control, we're going to play that strategy.
I mean, I'm sure a lot of Republicans will do that, but I don't think we know what the impact of, as polls currently indicate, a 10-point loss, inroads made in the Southwest and Southeast by Democrats, at least 5 Senate flips. Do you get 6 to 9 Republicans, depending on what the margin is, to say, even though that's what Ted Cruz and Rand Paul are saying, even though Mitch McConnell's in my ear saying we got to do 2009 all over again, do a bunch of folks say, you know what, this was such a disaster, the country's hurting, you got Democrats ginning up for a nuclear option, I need to dampen that, I need to show that we can govern again, and I'm not going to do what the party bosses tell me to do. I'm not saying that's a given, I'm just saying it's a possibility. Yeah.
Especially for senators who are up in 2022. I mean, that would be more likely.
There's 22 senators. If you're a Rob Portman in Ohio, I think he is 22, and Ohio might turn blue. North Carolina, you know, what if Tillis goes down? Richard Bray, I don't think, is running again, but maybe he's moved by that.
There's going to be all these turn Ohio blue in 2022, turn Arizona blue, whatever it is, it's going to rhyme with 22, right? We're going to hear a lot about this.
So I just think what happens next is very, very fuzzy. And if you're Pelosi, I don't think it's illegitimate to say, I don't know if there's another chance here. I need to get all I can when I can. And I mean, the fact that Trump has hurt his own leverage gives her more ability to say, I can hold out without suffering political consequences. So to go back to the Wolf Blitzer thing, was that a help or a harm to her? I think because you were getting voices on the left inside the Democratic caucus and without, starting to challenge her negotiating position, she had reason to shut it down and shut it down hard. She couldn't give credence to it without weakening her position.
Let me ask you this question. Do you think Pelosi did that on purpose?
Yes.
Or do you think she lost her cool?
I think it was totally on purpose. I do not think it was an emotional reaction.
So she went into that interview thinking, if Wolf Blitzer asked me a devil's advocate question or something, I'm going to accuse him of spouting Republican talking point. Like, that seems to me to be...
Yeah, she had to make those critiques, which were coming from the left, and Wolf Blitzer was characterized as coming from the left, she had to make them not sound like that. She had to make them sound like they were Republican, and the subject is, if you're a Democrat saying this, you're helping Republicans. I mean, she did it mostly by focusing on Wolf, but there were some elbows at Ro Khanna, too, in there. And Ro Khanna came out the next day at CNN, a little humbled, eating a little bit of crumb. He didn't totally flip over anything, but she was like, oh, I wasn't saying she had to take this deal. She should just take a deal. I respect Pelosi. I'm hearing some stuff from my constituents too. You know, he was a bit more mealy-mouthed the next day after that, because you cross Nancy Pelosi at your peril if you're a Democrat.
Well, I think one of the really cool things about this show, Bill, it's not that we disagree on issues. It's that we see our perception of things is different, right? Mm-hmm. And I think whether it's the Lindsey Graham ACB questioning or whether it's the Wolf Blitzer Nancy Pelosi interview, we saw it very differently, and I think that's cool.
So before we wrap things up, we should talk about, you know, presidential. Biden is.
How do you feel? Are you are you freaking out or are you calm?
I'm pretty calm. I you know, complacency is a bad idea. No one should think anything's in the bag. People should do their due diligence. And I, as I always say, if you know a big poll number is not a reason to be complacent, it's a reason to run up the score. And I think the Biden people are trying to run up the score for the most part. I think Biden could do more for Senate races, quite frankly. If I were Biden, I might take a trip to Montana or a trip to South Carolina. I mean, that's the one quibble I would have with their approach. They're advertising pretty broadly. They're in Texas. They're not in Texas as big. Mean, last I saw, he's in Texas in El Paso and San Antonio. Probably could be bigger, but, you know, they have $400+ million cash on hand. So maybe that's going to come in the final weeks. So look, no one's ever come back from 10 points down with 3 weeks to go. So it seems highly unlikely. That's my attitude. Now, there is that Tom Edsel piece, I don't know if you saw in the Times, is Biden out of the woods? Sean Trendy at the Real Clear Politics, an interview with the New Yorker, says stuff along the same lines. They're both leaning on the Dave Wasserman analysis that there's a bunch of white working class voters who didn't vote in 2016, the Trump could pull off the sidelines and upend the current poll models and make the polls wrong. And even though it's 10 points nationally, it's closer in the swing states, and that could make a difference in some swing states. Do you think there is credence to that concern on the Democrats' part?
Well, you know, my take on Trump, it's like the monster tin of the movie that keeps reanimating. You know, I will not believe that Trump, after what happened in 2016, I will not believe that Trump is gone until he, you know, gets on a plane and flies like Richard Nixon, or gets on a helicopter and flies away and Joe Biden is sworn in. So, but having said that, no, I mean, there are millions of working class white voters in Pennsylvania, for example, who did not vote in 2016. And you would assume that most of them would be Trump voters by virtue of their demographics. But that may not even be a safe assumption in 2020, right?
It's the margins. I mean, you know, Trump will win white working class, but probably not by the same margin.
There you go. And also, I mean, at some point they would have had to have registered to vote, right? I mean,
well, one of the arguments is that Republicans have done well with new voter registrations in 2016.
Well, I think Democrats apparently did sort of take their foot off the gas in terms of voter registration, probably because of COVID, because it's hard to stand outside of a grocery store and ask people or go door to door or whatever you're doing to canvass and get Democrats to register to vote. So, but I guess my point would be, I don't think it's enough. I don't think it's enough to make up for the problems Trump has. That's my gut.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I am too. I mean, you're gonna have new voters. So. What's that?
Then again, that was kind of my gut in 2016. Remember, I thought it was going to be closer than a lot of people thought, but at the end of the day, Hillary's going to have just a better get out the vote operation or something.
Well, what happened in 2016 was you had some rural surge, you had some white working class surge combined with some Democratic voter depression. You know, some would say suppression, I think at least depression. And I don't think you have that this time around. Yeah, Trump might pull some voters off the sidelines, but sure as hell Biden is too.
Yeah. Biden's going to do better with working class whites than Trump. And Biden's going to also do better, I assume, with the Obama coalition than Hillary.
Right.
So, I mean, either way you slice it, right?
The one wild card here that I think is hard to calculate from afar is the impact of increased mail vote. I mean, Wasserman just said yesterday that, you know, the turnout's going to be, I think, roughly 15 million more than it was last time. And I think mail voting has a lot to do with that, mail and early voting. And that just adds a wild card. You know, I mean, the assumption is that's going to benefit Democrats. And it may. When you ask in polls, how are you planning to vote? Republicans are far more likely to say election day than mail or early voting.
Yeah.
Part of me wonders, is that really true? Maybe you're saying that because that's sort of the thing to say if you're a Republican. But if that ballot is in your inbox, do you just do it quickly because it's there? If it is being sent to you, or if you get the application in your box, do you fill it out because it is convenient? And now there's also the human error element here. I mean, I think mail is great on net because it does jack up turnout, but there is an added increase of human error involved with it, depending on how complicated your state's rules are.
It's more likely to have your mail-in vote disqualified than to have your in-person vote disqualified.
You put it, you don't use the second envelope like you should if that's the case in your state.
Yeah.
You don't get the witness signature. You need a witness signature.
You've got one envelope that goes in another envelope. It's madness. But the other problem, of course, Bill, is that in places like Pennsylvania, last time I checked, they can't even start counting the vote, the mail-in vote, until election day.
Well, that seems to be
the case. It's possible that on election night, it looks like Trump's winning, and then the mail-in votes trickle in, it looks like voter fraud to Trump supporters.
Well, in general, the Rust Belt states do their early count vote slow because they wait until the day of. I think Michigan might have bumped it up a day, but Florida, Arizona, North Carolina, and other places, they do start the count earlier. So it is, and you know, Wasserman and Steve Shaw and others have said there are certain counties in Florida. Florida count should be in quick. And you should be able to see in certain swing counties how that's looking. And that will give you a pretty strong indication of how the night's going to go.
And not just the night, maybe the year.
Yeah.
If Biden on election night or early the next morning, if Biden has won Florida and Arizona, that's different scenario.
Well, Florida's it. I mean, if Florida's called for Biden by midnight election night, we all know that's it.
It's all over but the shouting.
Yeah. That's a real possibility. I mean, Florida has Florida's one state that has zigzagged a bit. It was sort of solid Biden in August, then it seemed more narrow in September. Now Biden's opening up a lead again. And look,
here's a question for you, Bill Scheer. Are you going to be live on YouTube election night watching the results?
I don't think so, for two reasons. One, there's so much live TV commentary. I mean, as much as I appreciate anyone who wants to hear me, you know, do real-time play-by-play, I imagine most people are listening to the CNN and MSNBC and whatnot, and getting those maps and getting that level of detail.
What if you came on live at 11:30 Eastern time for 15 minutes?
Maybe. The thing that is going to happen, because the last two election nights, I was asked to MC a local event, which, you know, went terribly in 2016. And I'm presumably not being asked to do it this time around.
Talk about a buzzkill.
Yeah, that was a very bad evening. I told the kids they could stay up late that night. And the kids don't really care about the election. They care about staying up late. And they said, well, can we do makeovers? and said, yes, you can do makeovers. So
this has to be filmed.
I don't think we want the live stream of the kids and me getting makeovers
Bill,
during election night.
That's going to get you over 1,000. This is the key. This is the stunt you've been waiting for as your manager, as your agent. This has to happen.
And honestly, I don't even know, like, what am I going to say? What are you and I going to say? I mean, assuming it's, you know, a Biden win.
Yeah.
What commentary is there to give? He won. End of discussion.
Say that about anything. What the hell are we going to add to a discussion when you've got, I don't know who, Andrew Yang out there? What are we going to add to a Democratic debate? And yet it doesn't stop us from doing hour-long shows week in and week out. What is it Homer Simpson said? Americans don't quit their job. They just show up every day and do a really half-assed job. So we can do it. And look, here's the thing. Americans are going to be super stressed out on election night. And if you were there to offer some comedic relief with a makeover, I think you're doing a service.
I'll consider it.
This has to happen. What if we got you to 1,000 what if 1,000 people pledged by virtue of subscribing to your shareable YouTube page? Would that be enough?
It still would have to clear the approval of the boss of the family.
That's right.
But we could Ross Perot this, you know, if the people demand it, if the volunteers in all 50 states get shareable on the ballot, you know, we'll have no choice but to go forward.
Here's the deal though, Bill. As soon as we get Amy Coney Barrett on the bench, you become the head of the household. And that's when we overturn this ruling about what you can put on YouTube.
Okay, so I'm never going to tell my wife that you said that for your own good.
I'm being sarcastic. And let me plug something. I don't know if this is going to happen or not, but supposedly my wife, Erin DeLulo Lewis, we call her EDL, mm-hmm. is going to do a Matt Lewis in the News podcast with me.
Wow.
Today. If, again, you know, this is all up in the air, but I'm lobbying her for this. And we're going to talk about what it's like trying to have it all, being a Christian conservative mom who runs her own business and is a wife and mother, and what that's like balancing. Mm-hmm. And can you have it all? Which I think, you know, clearly she does. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah. So I'm sure it's going to go well, Bill.
Well, good luck on that. I'll be listening.
I don't want your wife to be mad at me, Bill. So, you know, if the suits of Blogging Heads, if they need to edit that out.
Well, just stay between us.
It's not like, I mean, your wife may listen. My wife didn't.
Oh, she definitely does not listen. So you're fine on that score.
So if you're out there, do not tell her. Let's just say that.
We'll talk next week when I guess the Amy Coney Barrett Judicial Committee vote is next Thursday. And I think we have a debate scheduled for next week if it's not going to be canceled. But I think
there's two, as we record this, Bill, there are two town halls tonight
right.
to watch. We could, I guess, talk about that. I have a problem. I can't do a late DM Zoom tomorrow.
Okay.
I could do a morning or a noon DM Zoom.
That's fine. We can do that.
So then presumably we will talk about those town halls on that. And you can become – you can join us for that if you give us money. If you support our podcasts on Patreon. So do that and join us.
Absolutely. So I'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right.
I'll talk to you next week here in the DMZ.
See you guys.